Chapter 13. I'd never been a part of an angry, riotous mob hell-bent on seeking capital punishment for obvious reasons, so if anyone asked me 6 months ago if I'd ever be screaming for justice alongside everyone else, I would have said no. But currently that was exactly what I was doing, sans the torch and pitchfork, as I followed in the wake of the group of criminals heading for their deaths. There were at least 4 members of the illusionist pirate troupe, including Lord Licorice and the monkey guy I'd knocked out before I killed his twin. And in front of them, leading the pack, were the 3 Terran traders, which made a total of 7 people. At first, I didn't really relish the idea of marching a group of people to their executions, because I occasionally like to think I was born of a society a little more civilized. But I quickly stopped that line of thinking when more of these people's crimes were revealed. One of the interesting customs these Terrans observed was a pleasant thing Lord Grist dubbed the March of Repentance, down to something called the Cave of Judgment. To my recent knowledge, this was the last chance the criminals had to avoid death by ocean by being compelled to confess their crimes by the Augur Mage. Amaya and Anwar had once again linked hands as they urged the pack of degenerates along from behind. Both of their eyes were glowing along with each of their free hands, and the mage kept them moving while the Augur woman kept them talking. And talk they did. Each criminal spewed their guts about every misdeed or indiscretion that had ever harmed another person, until every single one of them dissolved into silent tears of guilt and remorse. All except one, Caxus. He, apparently, had a lot of shit to confess to, and where everyone else ran out of horrid crimes about 3/4 of the way down the sharp switchbacks, this sick fuck was still going. In fact, somewhere along the way, he even seemed to pick up steam, just like when he was confessing about him and Bardas, and the way his beady eyes gleamed as he described the perverted and fucked up shit they would do to the undeserving lower Terrans made my jaw clench. But when he started talking about the things he and his buddy Bardas used to do to children, yeah, that was when I threw my lot in with the crowd and started demanding bloody retribution, just like everyone else. Fuck evolved morality. People who messed with children deserve to die 1,000 deaths in the worst way possible. And to me, no amount of confession or Hail Marys or whatever the fuck could even remotely begin to exonerate a person for that. Not like Caxus wanted to be exonerated anyway, given the manic glee that seemed to roll off him even when he finally stopped confessing. Lord Gris had the mob come to a stop at the bottom of the nearly mile-long trek, and we all amassed in anticipation in front of the entrance of a dark cave. "My people!" the dino man said as his neck frill umbrellaed out and flashed a vibrant yellow to catch everyone's attention. "Now is the time to claim reparations for the terrible misdeeds laid against us by these deplorable reprobates." I added my voice to the roar of the crowd when everyone jeered and cheered. "I hope they burn in the darkest of dark hells," Horace said from his position next to me, and his voice was rife with the same wrath I felt burning a hole inside of me. "Now, only those who have been directly wronged by these loathsome scum may bear witness to the reckoning," Gris announced, and all of us who almost had our wives and daughters whisked away to the insanely fucked-up sex trade stepped forward. Thass, Virtus, and Sarek helped pass out torches for the people going into the cave. But I also made sure my doula stone was untucked from my shirt so it would give off its own shine. I remembered how dark the caves of Tear could get, and as we continued on the slightly downward slope, I was grateful for the extra points of light from all of the other duelists, newbies and vets alike. Especially because there was something markedly different about this cave. First was the sound. The draft that was blowing in and out had the effect of someone breathing as if they were in a deep slumber, and every time it wafted over me, the hairs on my arms and neck stood on end. Whatever else this Cave of Judgment was, it was definitely alive, and it was good the walk wasn't very long, considering how dark and endless the cave appeared from the outside. That fact was just another reminder of how supernaturally pitch black this high cavern was, because by all rights, we should have still been able to see the torchlights from all of the people waiting back at the entrance. I swallowed thickly, and my mouth went dry as a power I'd never felt before shrouded me like a thick lead blanket. It was as oppressive as it was awe-inspiring, and even Caxus seemed to finally realize where his place was in the cosmos. About 500 feet from the entrance, we all stopped at the edge of an inky, shallow pool with something that looked like a mound or a hill rising up from the center. When I squinted at it through the dimness, I was just able to make out the mound had a hole at the top, which made it look a little bit like a science fair model volcano, and from it came the sound of the ocean tide. This, at least, explained the illusion that the cave was breathing. This cavern must be close to Terre's natural bluffs, and over years of crashing and violent waves, the sea ended up punching a hole through the rock and formed this place. As the rest of the witnesses finished filing in around the shallow pool, I gripped my torch in my hand tight enough that the leather straps around the handle began to creak. Finally, Lord Griss raised his hand in a signal that had his guards escorting the 7 criminals to their place around the circular pool. And when the dino man dropped his hand, all of them were forced to kneel.
"Oh, Mercedes,"
the Terran Lorne said, as he beseeched the sky for the goddess's power.
"We have come to the Cave of Judgment to ask you for your wisdom and fairness. Have mercy on your righteous people, and help us punish those who have gravely maimed us."
Everything suddenly went so silent, not even the ocean's tide could be heard, as if everything outside of the cave had just stopped. Then, before I could wonder if I'd somehow accidentally summoned a time trance, a chest-collapsing roar shook the cave before ocean water geysered out of the top of the conical mound in the center. The criminals sputtered in shock as they were utterly baptized with the sickly, sweet-smelling water, and in the dimness, I could see all of the whites of their eyes as they frantically searched around for any sort of escape. But there was none.
"She has heard us,"
some of the other Terrans murmured amongst themselves in reverence, and I felt the sizzle of power against my skin like static. Then Amaya and Anwar walked out to stand just on the edge of the water, and in a synchronized effort, they raised their unlinked hands, which were both glowing white and red, respectively. Ribbons of glowing white water twined around and combined with Anwar's red tendrils of power. They snaked their way up from each criminal's feet and forced their way into their mouths. Then, with the help of the guards holding their mouths closed, all of them had no choice but to swallow. One by one, the 7 dropped to their knees in agony as the guards and the Augur Mage stepped back.
"You all have been weighed,"
Amaya said in her ancient-sounding multi-voice.
"And some of you have caused too much suffering. The balance must be restored."
The seawater gushed up into the cave again, and every single witness remained stone silent as we watched the criminals scream and clasp their heads. Their eyes rolled back in their sockets, and they gnashed their teeth in misery at whatever it was they were seeing in their minds. And several of the men began to bleed heavily from their noses as well as the corners of their eyes. 2 of the Terran traders, Jerris and Hervin, couldn't take the onslaught to their minds, and they dropped face down in the water, never to move again.
Gersh!
Another geyser. This time, when the water rained down on the remaining guilty men, 2 who I recognized as the bearded dragon jugglers, as well as the contortionist, reacted as if the sea spray falling on them was acid.
Gersh!
Another. The places where the water hit their skin started to leave behind boils and welts that disfigured them almost beyond recognition, until their faces ruptured and split. The effect was similar to slowly squeezing both ends of a ripe banana, and it was a good thing bananas weren't native to Aventol, because I was sure I'd never want to eat one ever again. Finally, there were 2 criminals left, and I ignored the one curled up in a fetal position so I could give my full attention to Caxus, because I had a feeling his punishment would be the grand finale. I wasn't wrong. The spike-faced man now covered in boils gagged as more water flowed up of its own accord and forced its way into his mouth and nose like an invading tentacle. His screaming was muffled as the water crammed itself deeper and made his throat and eyes bulge grotesquely. Then the ocean water actually began to lift him off the ground and slowly rotated him around like he was strapped to a circular rack until he was fully upside down and spread-eagled. I was unable to look away, even when the water distended his gut and finally came bursting out through his anus. And I especially didn't look away when the water then began to slowly expand, until the deplorable pedophile was ripped straight down the middle like the two halves of a phone book. The water hissed as the mist from the violent rendering rained down along with drops of blood and chunks of viscera. When all was said and done, the oppressive dark feeling in the atmosphere lifted, and in its place was a gentle sigh coming up through the throat of the Cave of Judgment. All of us breathed in relief as justice was served.
"Rise,"
Amaya said, and I was startled when I realized there was one member of the troop still miraculously left alive. Lord Licorice got to his feet, looking like a traumatized drowned rat.
"What is your name?" Lord Gris asked.
"Grell,"
the illusionist stated, as tears leaked steadily from the corners of his eyes.
"Grell Craven, from Lean."
Amaya then approached Craven, and when she held up her hand, the man flinched back ever so slightly.
"I will not harm you,"
the Oryx woman said. But she waited for his tight nod of consent before she placed her gently glowing palm against his cheek. There was a beat or two of silence while the Augur woman concentrated on what she was feeling before she opened her eyes again.
"Grell Craven, you have been weighed and judged by the goddess through her ocean of endless knowledge, and she has found your heart to be truly remorseful."
I didn't know," he sobbed. "I didn't know what they were planning, I swear it!"
"That is why you are still alive,"
Amaya said.
"The goddess is fair, and she knows of your ignorance. But now is your chance to forsake your pirating ways and do your penance. If Mercedes is ever forced to judge you again, she will not be so merciful."
"Thank you!"
The man sank down to his knees and kissed the back of Amaya's hand.
"Grell Craven, you will now be indentured to me as a servant, on strict probation," Lord Gris decided. "Any grave mistakes, and you will find yourself in a dark prison for the rest of your days. Are we clear?"
"Yes, Lord Gris,"
he said as he jumped back up to his feet.
"Thank you for your mercy, and I am truly sorry."
"Come on," I said to Horace and the mech sisters. "Let's get back." The whole trek back to the palace and up to our airship was spent in silence. Despite how enjoyable the evening was at the beginning, the way things had played out toward the end there kinda dampened the mood. And as we entered the courtyard, I stopped in my tracks.
"Chief?"
Horace questioned when he noticed I fell behind them all.
"What's up?"
"I'm just really glad to be leaving tomorrow," I admitted, as I gazed up at the airship gently floating on the magical current of air spiraling up from Tear's wide chasm. It wasn't Ithaca, but it was definitely a little piece of home. And even though we weren't returning to Nada just yet, it was enough to tide me over in the meantime.
"I feel the same,"
Amaya said as she slipped her hand in mine.
"Now come. I believe we have some people waiting for us."
I smiled at her, even though my heart felt bruised and sore. Justice was served, but it still didn't make up for all of those innocents who fell prey to both Caxus and Bardas. And Mira, along with other children, had been inside the cube today. Just thinking about what they were doing there made me shudder with rage and disgust all over again.
What?
I snapped out of the oncoming anger spiral when Amaya called my name seemingly for the second or third time.
"I know how you feel, darling,"
Amaya said, and she squeezed my hand to remind me we were still connected. So she was probably feeling all of my violent feelings through the bond. However, when I went to release my grip, she just held on harder.
"But what is done, and we can only look forward."
"I know," I sighed as we all entered the galley. "Annie and I are going to turn in," Horace said with his arm loosely wrapped around the Ibex woman's waist. The two of them had been wrapped around each other like that since the cave, like they were only upright because they were supporting each other.
Get some rest, Chief.
You guys too, I said, and waved at them as they went up the stairs and out of sight.
I need to go find my brother and his wife,
Amaya said, even as her hand still remained in mine.
I need to inform and update him on our plans before they head back to Natar on a separate ship.
Okay, I said hollowly, and finally let my grasp slip from hers.
Darling,
she said, and she held my face so I had no choice but to gaze into her gray eyes.
Promise me you will not dwell on the events of the night any more. There will be time tomorrow to revisit this if you wish, but for the rest of the evening, please be here now.
She finished by nuzzling her forehead against mine. So I closed my eyes as our arms came up and around each other at the same time, and we started to sway to our own silent music.
How do you do it?
I eventually asked in a low voice as we continued to slowly revolve. And when she made a questioning noise in the back of her throat, I rephrased.
How do you not dwell?
I only saw it with my eyes. I can't imagine having touched telepathy like you and having that knowledge. What I barely know is enough, and what I don't I can piece together, and it's making me sick.
Yes, the weight of knowing is a heavy burden to bear,
Amaya said, and pulled back so she could look into my eyes again.
It helps to remind yourself of what good fortune you do have. For me, I surround myself with the people who make me happy and make this dark world make sense.
I released a breath I didn't realize I'd been holding, and then leaned in to kiss her reverently on the lips. Thank you. You're right. And I love you.
I love you too, Alex,
she said.
Now, promise me.
I promise, I said with a smile. After we parted ways, I ascended the stairs to the third floor in search of the rest of my family. I told Amaya I wouldn't think about the disturbing events anymore, and that was just what I was going to do. The peaceful sight that greeted me when I made it into the small lounge area unraveled that last knot of tension between my shoulder blades, and the shroud of despair fully lifted off me. Because there was Zoe, my first wife, my mate, sitting on the low-backed sofa with Rylan curled up on his side with his head on her lap. She was humming some idle tune under her breath, and she carted her fingers through his sand-colored hair over and over again. My heart throbbed, and I felt warm in a way that had nothing to do with the fire burning cozily in the fireplace. I approached them silently in order to prolong this perfect moment in time. Yet I was compelled forward with the grasping urge to immerse myself in the tableau before me. As if Zoe sensed my internal struggle to approach without shattering the moment, she continued to hum down at Rylan as he slept the sleep of the truly exhausted. The only acknowledgement she gave me was the brief flicker of her deep blue eyes as I perched on the arm next to her, before she returned to gazing down at the boy in her lap. Even though it was obvious he was deeply unconscious, Rylan still had the shadow of a frown on his young face when it should have been slack with sleep and peaceful with innocence. Knowing that innocence was a little more stripped away tore at me. And it wasn't until this moment that I fully embraced the true responsibility of what fatherhood entailed. Rylan was no longer my foster son or even my adopted son anymore. As far as I was concerned, he was my son. No matter what he looked like, or who his biological father was.
Alex,
Zoe murmured, and I blinked down at both of our hands resting on top of Rylan's head. At some point, I'd reached down and curled my fingers around her hand that was trailing through our son's hair, which caused her to still.
We're right here, my love.
You think he'll be all right? I asked on an exhale. Her response was to lift our connected hands so she could kiss my knuckles.
He was strong before he came to us, and I like to think we have made him even stronger.
Even the strongest things can break, I whispered.
Then we will be here for him if he does,
she stated matter-of-factly. And I smiled at her before I ducked down so I could capture her lips in a long kiss. You keep me right, I said when I pulled back. I can't do this, be a parent, without you. I love you.
And I you, my love.
She purred before she kissed me sweetly once more.
Now, I'm going to tell you our darling Shay would like you to find her. She's currently under the galley.
Under? Do you mean she's below the airship where the power source is? I asked, and I had to lower my voice in the middle so my surprise wouldn't wake up Rylan.
That is what she said.
Zoe nodded. Interesting, I said, and an intrigued smile began to tug at my lips, since I'd yet to see how this puppy worked up close. Do you want me to help get him to bed for you before I go?
No, that's not necessary,
she said as her hand resumed its soothing trek through Rylan's tangled hair.
I'd rather he stay asleep than potentially wake and have to start the process of falling asleep all over again. He said he kept seeing that man's face in part of the mirror as he died every time he closed his eyes. He just truly fell under right before you came in.
I sighed and caressed his ink-smudged forehead with the back of my knuckles before I stood up. Do you need anything for the night?
I do not,
she replied. I still smoothed one of the light-knitted throw blankets I found on the back of an armchair over Rylan's feet. And then, with one last kiss to the top of my catwife's head, I went in search of Shay. The way to the engine room was a circular hatch in the galley's floor, which made sense because the galley was also the heart of the airship's interior. So it would make sense that the actual heart of the mechanical marvel was located in the same place. I grinned when I noticed the large rug Horace and I tore through when we first discovered the hatch. A perfect circle was punched out over the swinging hatch door, and nobody had thought to replace or remove it. We'd been spelunking through Monger Manor's inner workings when we came across a surprise pet project the place's previous owner left behind. Pet project being the minotaur-like abomination Gela Vane left for us to find like a fucking time bomb. If it weren't for quite a bit of luck and a convenient elevating pedestal, we would have become minced meat and would never have discovered how the upper wing of Monger Manor was actually designed as a detachable airship. Now that we'd figured out how to make her work, I was curious to see her in action. So, without wasting any more time, I pulled the hatch open and descended the iron ladder down to the platform below. When I got there, I had to practically scrape my jaw off the ground at the truly artistic craftsmanship I saw before me. The platform was clearly the work of Bowden and his excellent carpentry skills, because it now had a sturdy wooden railing wrapped all around it, as well as a wooden ship wheel that now housed the green tear-shaped crystal from Snake Tree. Back in Lower Tear, the ancient tree spirit had bequeathed me some of its essence for helping me to heal the jagged chasm where most of the demon scourge would spawn from and threaten the villagers. Now it was embedded in the center of the ship's wheel, and it was currently casting a gentle glow as it pulsed a little like a heartbeat. The light was just enough to see beyond the platform, and my eye traced the four beams extending from it. These beams reached far out and supported the airship's sails, and from below it, it would probably resemble something like a manta ray swimming gracefully through the clouds on its semi-translucent sails made from near-indestructible Terran worm skin. And it was on one of these beams that I found Shay sitting with her feet dangling down over the side as she looked out over Tear. Carefully, so I wouldn't startle her in case she fell, I climbed over the railing and walked out toward her. "I heard you wanted to see me," I said when she noticed my approach.
"The air feels so wonderful,"
she smiled and patted the space next to her with her hand, and I settled in close so I could feel the comforting heat of her body. I closed my eyes as I let the gentle zephyr caress my face and play with my hair. It smelled sweet, like how a fresh spring rain leaves behind the scent of plants and new life.
"Something's changed,"
Shay murmured.
"This is not the same Tear as when we got here."
"What do you mean?" I asked. She gave me a sly look at this as she tucked a strand of hair behind her ear.
"Do you want to see?"
Yes. I grinned at my phoenix wife's mischievous little smirk. I didn't know what I was expecting, but for Shay to suddenly jump off the beam definitely wasn't it.